Some have suggested that humans wouldn't last weeks if insects were to vanish from the planet.
As you might guess, we will indeed be talking about insects. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Salwa Khan. Scientists think insects originated on Earth about 400 million years ago, before any other animals, and developed and diversified along with plants. It's thought that insects and plants co-evolved, each one shaping the other. Insects were the first creatures to fly, and to this day, they serve essential functions in Earth's ecosystem. My guest in this program is Barrett Klein, who grew up fascinated by insects. Klein is both a scientist and an artist. He's an entomologist who at one time designed and built natural history exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. His new book reflects his scientific knowledge and his artistic skills. The book is The Insect Epiphany: How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. In his entertaining way, Klein relates how insects have affected human society, history, and culture. And the book is beautifully, even lavishly, illustrated. Here's Barrett Klein on what he does and why.
As an entomologist, you study creepy crawlies without backbones or spinal columns. But technically, it's those who study insects. And I was drawn to entomology when I was five, although I didn't know quite how I'd wrangle insects or appreciate them or explore them. I knew at that ripe old age that they would be at the core of my existence in some fashion. Wow. And in terms of how to go about that, I just read a lot about insects. My father would leave a pile of articles and a book in front of me about insects to foster that interest.
You've written this book, The Insect Epiphany: How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. How did you come to write the book?
Well, I've long been in love with insects, but also how insects affect human history and human cultures. And Timber Press reached out to me from Portland, Oregon, to ask me if I'd be interested in writing such a book. And it's difficult because if you write a book about a taxon, a lineage of organisms so vast, diverse, and important as insects, and try to figure out a way to encapsulate their effect and impact on human cultures, it can be overwhelming. And I decided best way for me is to write stories and figure out which aspects are most exciting and appealing to me. And the way I approached it was eventually, as I was writing, was to think about how we use insects, their products, their bodies, dead or alive, and then how we build insects, how we can learn from them, and if not use them or their products directly, can we biomimetically engineer them for different purposes? And then the third was a metamorphosis section, or how we become insects, or how it might be pragmatic to try to imitate insects, replicate their behaviors for the arts and for other reasons.
In the book, you include arachnids, which are not, as I understand it, technically insects. Why do you include them?
I mean, it would have been an abomination not to include at least spiders in some senses, because I spend time talking about silk and its importance, mm-hmm. and who are some of the great silk producers? Spiders. And spiders, yes, are not insects. We're looking at arthropods. And arthropods are the most diverse lineage, the most speciose or species-rich taxon or group of animals on the planet. So with about 1.8 million described animals, for example, 1.1 million are insects alone. So the arthropods have jointed segmented legs and chitinous exoskeletons. So they have to molt in order to grow. So whenever you have segmented jointed legs in this exoskeleton, you're an arthropod. If you have six segmented jointed legs, three major body regions, a pair of antennae, and you're definitely an insect. Arachnids, instead of having three major body parts as adults, they have two major body parts. They do have segmented jointed legs, but they have four pairs rather than three pairs. They have eight walking segmented jointed legs, no antennae, certainly no wings, and most insects have wings.
There are many fascinating statistics in this book, and I was wondering, now this is from the copy that I had. On page 15, there was a paragraph that went through several of the statistics. I wonder if you could relate them for
Oh,
us
sure.
or read it.
Yeah, I could read part of that paragraph if you'd like.
Sure.
A locust swarm can contain 1 billion grasshoppers. A marching raid of driver ants can consist of 50 million workers, and the total number of ants on Earth may exceed 20 quadrillion. Pile just the carbon atoms making up all these ants on a scale, and that stack would weigh more, 12 million tons, than all the world's wild birds and mammals put together, and equal 20% of the dry carbon mass of all humans. Throw in all the other insects, and they may number 1.25 billion for each human, and 10 quintillion total, give or take a magnitude or so. This vast workforce is so vital that to stand in the way of insects, to destroy their habitats, to squash or spray them out of hand, or to deny their importance comes with consequences.
Or you talk about several insects, and one of them, or one of the first you talk about, is the silkworm. And there's some fascinating stories around that, including how we think the first person discovered, I guess, that the worms were spinning this silk.
Yes, Empress Leju about 5,000 years ago. Would you like for me to read a little segment?
Sure.
Dislodged from a high tree branch by a curious crow, a cocoon falls. Inside, a single plump larva, after weeks of eating, growing, molting, then building and transforming, is on the verge of molting again, this time to reveal legs, compound eyes, and wings. Plummeting from her high perch, the larva's quiet transition into a moth is interrupted by a soft landing in a hot cup of tea. Nothing in her species' evolutionary history prepared her for the heat that melts the glue, binding the fibers of the walls that encase her. The fibers unravel, the influx of scalding liquid engulfs her, and her metamorphosis is cut short. The tea, her tomb, belongs to an empress, sitting in the shade of a mulberry tree in her imperial garden. Initially startled, Leju is transfixed by the shimmering threads snaking on the surface of her beverage and takes note of the hapless victim, half hidden within the dissolving cocoon. The thread continues to lengthen and continues to glimmer. An idea crosses Leju's mind as she has a lady in waiting pinch one end of the fiber and walk away. Down the garden's path, across the courtyard, beyond the fortress's walls, the servant finds herself at long last in the Forbidden City, far from the mulberry tree with the tiny teacup, the caterpillar, and the crow.
And then you talk about two major world events, the Silk Road and then the plague. And the way you relate it is that they began through the activities of two insects.
So the Silk Road famously was a series of interconnected roads and networks across much of the old world. And the primary material good that was the focus of commerce was silk, although many other material goods were spread along this road. And it affected many things, not only the spread of language, religion, ideas. The Great Wall of China was enhanced as a result, defending this road in part. But when you spread things like that and make connections with humans, you also facilitate the spread of disease. And the Black Death, which is a bacterial pandemic vectored by initially by rat fleas biting humans, then raged through much of the world at the time, Europe, Asia, North Africa. Europe's population was halved at least once. So the Black Plague really resulted in the greatest wave of human death the world had ever seen. And the rate of transmission was fast, but not fast enough for rat fleas to account for the great numbers and at that rate. So scholars suggest that it actually transitioned to human fleas carrying pneumonic plague and then were spread by human coughs rather than the flea bite. But that said, the initiation was from a bacterium within a flea on a rat that was spread largely by the Silk Road. So here you've got this insect that was heralded as a commercial success story that enhanced people's lives in many ways, Bombyx mori, domesticated silkworm moth. And then another insect that was the scourge that would cause buboes and agony and death.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, and I'm here today with Barrett Klein. He's an entomologist and author of a book called The Insect Epiphany. And we're talking about various insects, and one of them was, of course, this silkworm. And then I understand that silk, the product, was used during World War I in various ways. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so writing this book, I was surprised day to day, diving down rabbit hole after rabbit hole and learning more about the different uses of insects in our culture. And one of those ways that really surprised me, yes, was wartime use of silk, either from spiders or silkworm moths. Some were used for sighting in optical technologies, where the silk thread is so consistent and durable that black widows and other spiders were raised for silk threads to be used in this way. But then silkworm moths producing silk that could be woven into fabric bags were used to hold powder charges, and sources I explored claimed that every big artillery ever shot and fired by the United States was held by a silk bag. Now, why? The reason being that silk, when burned, doesn't leave a trace, it kind of vanishes.
Silk was also used to make bulletproof vests. That's one of the many great stories in Barrett Klein's book, The Insect Epiphany. He also details how bees make honey, and along with other insects, how they make wax.
Oh, so many different insects produce wax for all manner of reasons. For example, cochineal bugs produce a waxy secretion that cover their bodies, partly to protect them against potential predators or parasites, but also as an anti-desiccant so they don't dry out in their desert environments. But others produce wax to build. So honeybees, some of the workers, will secrete these silvery wax scales from the ventral side of their abdomens, and then they'll take those scales and they'll masticate, they'll chew them up, they'll heat them up, contracting wing muscles. And then as they melt, they'll chew them into these prismatic, hexagonal, lightweight yet durable honeycombs in which to store their developing brood, their pollen, their honey. So wax is a very versatile material that has attracted humans over the ages. As you know, it's been used for candles, but also cosmetics, coatings, medicinals, adhesives.
And then there is this ink made from the galls formed by the oak gall wasp. And I understand this was a fascinating story that I'd never heard. So this was used apparently to write some very important documents, including the Constitution of the US. Is that right?
That's right. Pick some of the biggest ones: Declaration of the US, the US Constitution, the Magna Carta, limiting King John of England's powers. And what you find is that the very ink that was chosen for these and so many famous music compositions and Van Gogh and others' art pieces is long lasting, and it's from the tannins of oaks that gather in galls, and galls are induced in plants by herbivorous insects, some insects that can cause a chemical cascade in those plants. So, for example, there are species of these gall wasps in which the female will insert her egg-laying device, lay an egg or several eggs, and the developing young will produce chemicals that elicit this behavior in the plant that builds this protective. Sometimes it's bubbly or ball-shaped, can take all kinds of different forms. And the gall wasps, they form these very typical gall shapes that serve, for the insect purposes, as shelter and a food source. But tannins gather, and people have found that you can extract those tannins, prepare them in a really simple way to produce a long-lasting ink. And the oak gall is just particularly famous in history because of the extraction of this long-lasting, relatively light-fast ink. Although you go to Washington, D.C., and if you want to visit some of these documents, they're kept very carefully under low lighting conditions in hopes of preserving them over the long haul, along with the Star-Spangled Banner, whose red comes from a different insect source, the cochineal bug.
Yeah, now tell us about that. You mentioned that earlier. So there's a dye that comes from it.
Yeah, so what Amy Butler Greenfield writes in her beautiful book, A Perfect Red, the cochineal bug is a scale insect that many from Europe and the Old World had no clue what it was, but the Aztec people and Maya people were domesticating or raising these scale bugs for over 1,000 years to be these bulbous, female, worm-like, berry-like bodies on prickly pear cacti. And when harvested, dried, pulverized, stored in various ways, sometimes like hockey pucks, they'd be sent by the ton by Spanish conquistadors, second only to silver as an export to Europe. And then this red source of organic red paved the way for many artists, nobility, and clergy, and others to serve as status symbols of power with this glorious deep scarlet red. And depending on the mordant you use, your fabric can, your textiles can appear anything from this red to a deep purple.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Barrett Klein, entomologist and author of the book, The Insect Epiphany. And in another part of the book, you talk about the ways in which humans have perhaps watched insects and come up with inventions, sort of by imitating. For example, you talk about paper and the wheel, invention of the syringe. Can you tell us some of that?
There's at least one scholar who claims that all it took was a few intuitive steps for humans to see a dung beetle rolling a dung ball across the earth as as inspiration for the most iconic of human invention, the wheel. So people have been looking at dung beetles a long time. In fact, Khepri, the morning manifestation of the sun god Re in ancient Egypt, was seen as a god that would, in the form of a scarabaeus sacer, the sacred scarab beetle, rolling a celestial body across the earth, across the sky. And here, a claim is that dung beetles were attracted to agricultural assets, domesticated animals, because here they were congregated, thanks to humans, producing a lot of dung, producing a lot of dung beetles that would roll the dung away. And then the farmers would see that, hey, maybe we could attach such things to our now load-bearing domesticated cattle to do much of our work for us. It's an idea.
Right.
S more directly and better documented is the syringe. So Dr. Wood, over a century ago, had a patient who was dying, and he knew that he had to deliver something into the body of this person, but how to do it most effectively. And he came up with a glass syringe, the first, and he was inspired by a honeybee stinger. And here we are over 100 years later, and labs are looking at mosquito mouth parts to po potentially follow up with a relatively pain-free syringe for vaccinations, for example.
And then I thought this was very exciting, which is that certain worms can eat and digest plastic, that bane of our existence,
Oh, yeah.
including styrofoam. Is this so? And
You're
what?
right. This is a scourge. I mean, the amount of single-use plastics in the world is absurd. And humans have to be more responsible to prevent the, for example, the Texas-sized clump of plastic in the Pacific, as well as the other the aggregations of plastic that are spreading across the world and are now found in the deepest abysses of the ocean. And so to solve this problem, people have been thinking about bacteria, fungi, and in some cases, even insects. And some of these tests show that waxworms or mealworms, these are moth and beetle larvae, show some evidence that plastics can be chemically degraded in the process of their consuming the styrofoam or plastic bags. So is there potential there? I imagine there's a combinatorial action of bacteria, fungi, and insects in breaking down this waste product of ours.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Barrett Klein, entomologist and author of the book The Insect Epiphany. And you talk about eating insects. Tell us about that and what insects can and are being used as food.
Well, in the section where I talk about color and the origin of color, I ask a question. So if you're out in the woods, for example, which, if you needed to or wanted to, which insect would you choose to consume? Would it be this brightly colored, gaudy insect, or would it be something like a leaf mimic, browns and maybe greens or something like that? And the survival ready response should be, go for something muted, go for something camouflaged, don't go for something that would be bright red or orange or high contrast, for example, because those typically are nature's warning colors. Those insects that are, say, orange, black and white, like a monarch butterfly, have some degree of protection against being eaten. So if you're out in the wild and say you're trying to survive and you're supplementing your diet with arthropods, yes, move away from those brightly colored insects. And largely, many of those that aren't aposematically colored are palatable. Now, I'm not saying to jump in your backyard and pop an insect in your mouth without some degree of care, but you probably don't, you won't face the same consequences as a naive mushroom picker might. Insects traditionally have been eaten all over the world, and by a very conservative estimate, an article suggested that 1,611 species of insects have been traditionally consumed. Now, the number is certainly much higher. This was looking very carefully through the literature and establishing the identities of these insects and confirming that they're consumed. So you can go to a place like Oaxaca, Mexico, and find that over 150 species are traditionally consumed. And this can be everything from grasshoppers chapulines and tacos, or you can find stink bugs that are in really fancy dishes. But the range is broad.
I mean, what do they taste like?
Oh, all over the place. Like so for example, I just went to the Wisconsin Book Festival and gave a presentation and had a variety of insects available for people to test, to try. And some of them included grasshoppers and crickets and beetle larvae. And then there's an ant. So I'll focus on ants because a lot of the insects, depending on how they're prepared, can be nutty, they can be fatty. Termites, for example, are high calorie, can be fatty. With ants, it can be all over the place. The ants that Joseph Yun had given me to share with people taste lemony. All you need is a tiny, tiny pinch, and it adds this really strong lemony flavor. But way back when I was naive about a certain subfamily, Dolichodurini, of ants, and living in Tucson, Arizona, I had a jar of honey on my counter. And I came back from school and I found that there was a tiny ants all in a row, forming a trail across my counter, up the jar, under the lid, and dying in a layer on the surface of the honey. Enough were surviving that they would remove honey, lay more trail pheromone, and more would try to extract the honey. But not one to waste food, I took my knife and I scooped up some honey, spread it on some bread, and I was shocked. So I tried the bread alone, it was fine. Tried the honey alone, it was fine. Then tried it with the ants. Blue cheese tasted just like blue cheese.
Wow.
And I should remark that eating insects isn't for everybody. So, for example, if you're a vegan or a vegetarian, insects would be off your palate, right?
Right.
If you have reasons that are based in religion or spiritual, if you have ethical lines that you draw where you don't want to kill and consume insects, these are all reservations. Now, I talked about how eating insects can be relatively sustainable. We look to a cow, a pig, a chicken. These are so wasteful in terms of how we raise them, how we prepare them, all the wastewater, how little we use actually of their bodies, that compared to these, insects are far more sustainable. We use per capita more of their proportion of their bodies, use less water waste, they have a higher protein content, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
But next to eating just a non-animal based diet, of course, that's more sustainable.
That's all for now. This has been Mothering Earth on insects and what they do for us. Thanks so much to Barrett Klein, author, entomologist, and artist. And thanks so much to you for listening. Our website is mothering-earth.com. Until next time, this is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.